Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, I'm Stephen, and on this week's special episode of the New Statesman podcast, we talk about which ministers we think are the worst, which front benchers we think are the worst, and...
I interview John Ridding, CEO of Room to Read, plus a special holiday-themed You Ask Us. Hello and welcome to a pre-potted episode of the New Statesman podcast. Stephen and I are both on holiday this week, so this is something we cooked up for you a week earlier. I really hope there's not some, like, we're going to look so bad if Theresa May's government finally falls.
It suddenly occurs to me there are sort of a couple of horrendous possibilities. One is the government. Well, I'm thinking is if the government falls, right, that ruins the holiday because we just have to get, you know, planes or trains back from our respective locations. So at least that kind of fixes itself. My sudden fear is, so the pre-potted thing we're doing is we're going to be doing effectively a 10-minute hate on our least favourite ministers and front benchers. Now, what would we do if Richard Grayling were...
Wow, a sort of terrible conglomeration of Richard Bergen and Chris Grayling, imagine
if Chris Grayling or Richard Bergen have died by the time this podcast comes to air.
I think we probably just wouldn't put it out.
I guess we just wouldn't.
But they both look very well, so
they
let's
do look
keep
very
our
well.
Fingers crossed. But also, you kind of... bit of a spoiler alert about who we think are the worst ministers. I have sparred with Richard Bergen, who is Labour's shadow justice spokesman, before when I said, was he in a witness protection programme? Since then, I have sort of not revised that view. I know you, well, you know I'm interested in prisons policy anyway. The one that maybe interests you more is drugs policy, and which kind of feeds into prisons policy too, right? We have huge amounts of spice, these psychoactive substances going into prisons, and we really aren't kind of dealing with that very well. But
they're intimately linked, in my view, partly because of the amount of drugs there are in our prisons, but because one of the central problems is we send too many people, as you know, we send too many people to prison for too many short sentences. And many of the people we send to prison actually go deeper into crime. Prison is just bad most of the time. It is a really ineffective tool of criminal justice policy. And a large number of people who should not be in prison are there for drugs-related offences. So I think the two are inextricably linked. I guess drugs policy particularly bothers me because the orthodoxy on it has moved for so many reasons because of various campaigning groups.
Well, actually, not least as you've now got a generation of ministers who most of them, unless they were chronically dull, might have come a bit near a spliff at university on the basis that loads and loads of people that happens to.
Yeah, and they can't, even if you yourself haven't, you can't really claim that, you can't go, oh, well, everyone I know who's done that has lived a life of...
has died of cannabis, yeah.
Thing is, I simply do not buy the argument that our political parties could not have a more enlightened, more science-based position on drugs. I mean, if someone can find me the voter who is currently voting for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, who if Richard Bergen went, of course, we will legalise the sale of cannabis, as opposed to this kind of mimsy, you know, waiting until, you know, the world's most photogenic child was, you know, on the verge of dying from electricity. Yeah, for medicinal purposes, we're cool with that. With prisons, again, I think the maddening thing is one, there doesn't seem to be any particular Labour presence in terms of getting into the teeth of a pretty rubbish area of government policy. But two, yeah, this whole kind of, oh, we just need to pay prison officers more. It's just like, well, I'm fine. I'm not opposed to paying prisoners' officers more. I would also like there to be fewer of them because we should have fewer people in prison.
Right. I think one of the things that struck me when I went into those prisons the year before last was that starting salary is low 20,000s for a prison officer. And, you know, the amount of spice that you can essentially smuggle into prison up your bum is about 8 grand. So if you think about that, about the potential for corruption there, most prison officers aren't and do a very, very difficult job for very low pay. But as a kind of crude economic incentive to break the rules, the price of street drugs is just astonishingly high. So that's Richard Bergen. Sorry, Richard, if you're listening to the podcast, you probably didn't enjoy that segment. But you might enjoy this one, Chris Grayling.
I mean, Chris Grayling, like...
Where do I begin with Chris Grayling? That man has got the opposite of a Midas touch.
I think the thing is also, at least Richard Bergen's presence in the Shadow Cabinet is explicable.
Because there weren't very many Corbynites and he was willing to be in the Shadow Cabinet when almost no one else was.
Yeah, fine, right? Chris Grayling's one purpose in the Cabinet is as someone who is loyal to Brexit and loyal to Theresa May, as someone who guarantees her sufficiently Brexit credentials. Her sufficiently Brexit credentials are gone. They've been blown to pieces. So why is he still there? It's not because of his record of delivery. He's failed in every department he's in. It's not because of his following in the parliamentary party. It's not because of his standing in the Conservative Party.
It's because of his raw sexual charisma, Stephen.
In the country. I mean,
he's not good on telly. It's not like one of those things where you go, oh, well, okay, I'm not sure that Barry Gardiner is the most effective, you know, ministerial head, but actually, you know what? You can put him on a sofa and he doesn't disgrace himself. Chris Grayling is like, it's like what, I mean, it's not like, I was going to say it's like watching paint dry. It's like watching Ian Duncan Smith dry. I mean, it's bad.
Yeah, I think basically all of the other bad ministers, I mean, again, Ian Duncan Smith, I think is probably the contender for the worst cabinet minister.
But he's like Hall of Fame bad, right? In the sense that he just went into a department, went, I've got a faith-based proposition and I will, the harbinger of Brexit, if you just believe in it hard enough, it'll work, which is just a bad thing that we should never allow to happen again.
But I can at least understand, again, why Ian Duncan, you know, he had a following in the parliamentary party. He had his various boosters in bits of the right-wing press. Fine. Again, I don't like when he's there. I wish he hadn't been there. But at least it's a bad thing and I can understand why the bad thing is happening to me. Chris Grayling is a bad thing, then there is no longer a justification for the bad thing happening.
Well, that was pretty pretty brutal. Are there any women you think are rubbish, just in the interest of gender equality?
Any women who I think are rubbish? Well, so she's not in the Shadow Cabinet anymore, but on the Labour side... there is really only one contender for worst minister, Debbie Abrams. I mean, as Welfare Secretary was essentially invisible, did very little to get the agenda up the news. And then, obviously, one of the problems that her successor, Margaret Greenwood, who also hasn't pulled up any trees, have, is there is no money to reverse any of the Conservative cuts, and Labour's spending plans assume as a baseline the welfare cap, which means you're kind of boxed into a corner because you kind of are starting
going, this regime is terrible. This is making people really unhappy. People are having to go to food banks and take out emergency payday loans. What are we going to do about it? Good question.
Yeah. And that is hugely because of Debbie Abrams' inability to secure funding to advocate for her brief during the manifesto meeting. And that is essentially the big difference between, you know, with education, you had Angela Rayner going, no, I want all of this money for the various things I think are important in my brief. In Shadow Home, you had Diane with a very radical set of proposals about how we treat refugees and asylum seekers. And then you have in Shadow Justice and Shadow Welfare, you have, well, at least in Shadow Justice, you had Richard Bergen going, oh, the problem is there isn't enough money going to prison guards. So at least he was asking for a financial commitment. Debbie Abrams just did not seem to take the process very seriously. She then, obviously, as people will know, one of my pet peeves are people who are then ungrateful to a political win that was considerably fairer than they
Gerard O'Mara project,
Gerard
if you
O'Mara
will.
Project, right? So then when she was accused of bullying, she did that statement going, actually, the leader's office has been unfair to me. No other leader of the opposition in the history of the world would have tolerated a lead on an area of such government vulnerability who was so anonymous and so ineffective. So, you know, it's just one of those things where it's just like, so you've been rubbish, but you're also apparently so unaware of your rubbishness that you're going to complain about being turfed out of your job, finally. On the Conservative side, I mean, it does make you realise there are actually so few of them.
Yeah, and actually then generally the ones who managed to, because there are so few of them, the ones that managed to reach the Cabinet are not, well, Priti Patel.
I think it's actually Priti Patel, while what she was doing was evil, you can't...
She was good at it.
You can't, yeah, this thing is, because if we were doing kind of, you know, ministers who I every day wake up in a kind of thing, just like, oh God, I really wish their fingers weren't near the lever of power. She would have been a very strong contender, but she was running her department. I think actually it occurs to me that then the overwhelming contender, and it's one of those kind of things that you always kind of miss when you go, oh, who's rubbish? Of course, is Theresa May herself. She does not run Downing Street particularly well. the thing I think is really fascinating is that one of the problems with Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill was the using of their office to hold grudges and behave in a way which was both unprofessional, damaging to the government, and upset and created a lot of enemies they didn't need to create within the Conservative Party and outside of it. Now, the fascinating thing is since the election, she's had to be more emollient. She's brought in Gavin Barwell, who...
Former Croydon MP.
Former Croydon MP, well-liked in the Parliamentary Conservative Party. And as her chief comms person, she's brought in Robbie Gibb, formerly of the BBC. And although neither of them, I would say, have behaved anything like as badly as the chiefs, civil servants don't feel that they're bullied and, you know, and like going into work again. The fascinating thing is both have behaved in ways that I think have been slightly unprofessional, and I don't think are ways they would have behaved before they arrived. So there is clearly an institutional culture problem. So, I mean, Robbie Gibb, for example, getting in that public spat with Christian Guru Murphy about him being biased, and he's just like, mate, you're a public servant. You're not some rando activist having a weird row about Brexit.
But also, I mean, I've met Robbie Gibb quite a lot because he used to be in charge of the Sunday Politics, which I used to be a regular on. And, you know, he came from being a Conservative student to working at the BBC to then going to work for the Conservative Party. So I don't think there's any argument about where his ideological underpinnings are. The question is whether or not he put them aside during the time he was at the BBC. And I think, by and large, I am okay with the idea that people who work from the BBC have their own ideologies. They just have to put them aside when they're at work. But I agree with you. It was a bit pearl clutchy to go, how could you possibly say I have political opinions? It's like, you left the BBC to go and work for the Conservative Party, I think.
Yeah, QED. I mean, I also think, so the thing I'm a bit meh on is, although obviously, you know, loads of people who work in broadcasting have politics and that's fine, and most of them do put them to one side, because Robbie often seems to interpret all analysis that is unfavourable to the Conservative Party leadership as politically motivated or as some kind of political animus, it is quite hard to look back at the decisions he made as producer and not go, well, if this is your lens through which you view every criticism of your politics now, it's hard for me to accept your rationale for the decisions you made at the BBC. But I just think in general, and so Gavin Barwell, someone I have a huge amount of time for as an operator, et cetera, did still have those weird briefings with the pro-Brexit journalists about Chequers, which, as in the words of one of the civil servants who had to do some of the pre-prep for it, they just said, I don't understand what the point of those were for. It was widely leaked because it annoyed all of the people in there. And it did essentially feel like him calling them in there to be like, and another thing I don't like about your characterization of Brexit, which I think, you know, one of the main qualities of a leader that we kind of underrate is their ability to get everyone who works for them to anticipate their demands without them being asked. And it feels to me that one of the fascinating things about May is the demand that she gets people to anticipate is engage in petty acts of recrimination that will not help you or your side.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And I'm joined by John Ridding, CEO of the Financial Times and the new global chair of Room to Read. I went to Nepal earlier this year with the charity and had an incredible time learning about particularly girls' education. I talked to some girls who had been former Kamlari, indentured servants, and were now catching up on their education too late. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I got into knowing about Room to Read because of a breakfast that you had where you talked about your experiences in the country, some of the countries you'd visited. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
Sure. Well, I first came across Room to Read when I was a reporter based in Asia, and came across the founder, John Wood, who was explaining the mission and the importance of the mission and just how many people were illiterate, particularly children, particularly girls. But at that time, it was very much sort of data-based, and I was looking at the data. I'm an FT journalist, so very preoccupied by the data. But I think the real moment of impact was when I went on a trek to Cambodia in 2007, and it was near Angkor Wat, and just seeing the enthusiasm and the hunger of the children there, particularly the girls, for education, many of whom had very difficult home stories, alcoholic fathers, broken families, having to stay at home to work to help make a living, and generally the girls. If anyone was going to school, it would be the boys. The girls didn't get there. And I remember in particular seeing a speech from a girl called Dum Hawe, who was representing Room to Read in front of some pretty intimidating local officials, and did so with tremendous confidence and energy. And I think that just made the whole thing real and memorable. And obviously the data and statistics are crucially important. It's a very data-driven and efficient organization. We take the data very importantly, but it's really when you see the children and what it means to them and how hungry they are for learning. And quite often when one comes back to the UK or anywhere else, and you know, school can sometimes seem a bit of a chore for children, and do I have to go? And then you kind of explain what a privilege it is and how fortunate they are. That makes a difference.
I think one of the things that I thought was really interesting about my trip was understanding really how much change you can make by increasing child literacy. And in a world in which our problems sometimes seem so big and so hard to tackle, actually the real difference that is made just by getting more children into school and getting them to stay in school. As you say, the girls were particularly, is one of my focuses too, you know, talking about the fact that I talked to one girl who was taking her brother's exercise books, you know, which had been done in pencil, soaking the pencil marks out so that she could use them again because she couldn't get her own textbooks. And the Millennium Development Goals, which were about child literacy, have now moved now into Sustainable Development Goals. But can you talk to me a bit more about what the kind of effects of increasing literacy are?
Yes, they are broad and they are deep. And, you know, frankly, my day job is the FT. And I personally feel that many of the problems and crises that we cover and write about and report would be addressed more easily earlier if there were more educated and literate people, whether it's economic development. I think it's shown that a more literate society, particularly with women more involved in the workforce, is wealthier. They generate more income for their families and for society. Whether it's health and health-related issues, there's a study by Jean Sperling, published by the Council on Foreign Relations, that shows that every extra year a girl spends in school, or a woman, reduces infant mortality by 10 to 15%. The environment, environmental awareness, conflict situations. So many of the big issues that then develop and become major problems that we report about actually quite often have their roots in a lack of education. So many problems that we face now would be addressed more effectively with a more literate population. And the numbers are staggering. I think it's something like 758 million people in the world are illiterate. Two-thirds of those are women and girls, and something like 250 million children across the world aren't in primary school. So it's a big challenge.
I think that was one of the things that really came quite strongly across to me, is increasing female literacy, increasing female participation in the workforce just gives women, because they have economic power, it gives them huge social power as well, you know, and the ability to resist getting married very young. We went to a village in Barda province in which we met a woman who's only 10 years older than me, but she'd been married at the age of 9. And her daughter had been put into indentured servitude because they lived in a very scrappy part of the country where, you know, they were saying, well, we have elephants here. And I kind of went, oh, elephants, amazing. And they said, well, no, what happens is that the elephants come and charge through the barn and they destroy it. And then we have to rebuild it because we don't have any insurance because we're technically squatters. You know, the tigers come out of the forest and eat our goats that we rely on for milk. So living in this incredibly beautiful landscape, but scratching out a really hard living in it. And actually what happens if you have educated daughters is they get much more ability to have a say over their own lives. And I think that's what really came across quite strongly to me.
And of course, there's the multiplier effect, because if you educate a girl, she becomes a woman and probably a mother. She then can educate her family. So it's a much more, it's obviously fair is important, but it's obviously much more effective and efficient too in spreading literacy and education.
And how do you choose the countries in which you operate? Because you have quite a lot of countries in the Far East, that you are a couple in sub-Saharan Africa, but you try and avoid ones that are riven by sort of civil war or conflict, because you can't, is that right? That you can't just kind of get the penetration of help into them.
So we're in 15 countries now and eager to operate wherever we can generate good outcomes. That does involve working closely with local communities and the government, because we need to scale our presence and our operations. So really it's a question of what that partnership looks like. If it can be effective, then we're, you know, very keen to work in those countries, but we need to have that. as it were, partnership with government and with local communities, because I think what we don't want to be is, or what we're definitely not, is an organization that just sort of builds a library or builds a school and then hands it over, because what we've experienced is you need that aligned systemic approach that everybody is involved in this project. So the environment in terms of the government and social relationships really, really matters to us.
And in Nepal, had moved from a system of picking out girls and trying to help, you know, people who are seen as being at risk of truancy, to kind of working across the entire age group. Is that something else that you've, you know, that what was the research that was based on, that move?
I think a lot of our work is based directly on education research and pedagogy and what works most effectively for sustained learning and literacy. And at the moment, we're looking at even younger cohorts, because the research shows that the earlier you start on the literacy journey, the more effective it's going to be. And that's the other element, I think, of Room to Read, that it's obviously a very inspirational, indeed emotional mission, but it's extremely rigorous in terms of how it goes about its methods. We measure things very carefully. We publish an annual report which shows, for instance, that in every country in which we operate, that the results in terms of literacy, which effectively is words read per minute at the key levels of 20 words a minute or 45 words a minute, outscore the government schools by a margin in every single case. And that's really the result of having a very effective system, training the teachers' assistants, and most recently developing a cohort of Room to Read teams, which I saw in action in northern India, called social mobilizers. And they are women typically in their sort of 20s, I guess, maybe early 30s, whose role is to be mentors to girls in the local community, girls whose family's first thought wasn't, well, you should go to school. Actually, quite often that's very far from being their first thought. But these social mobilizers develop relationships with girls and with their families, explain to them they have absolutely a right to be educated, that it's a valuable thing, making the family feel at ease with that. And then being there in the schools with the girls and helping them deal with some of the prejudices and some of the challenges they face.
I met a couple of social mobilizers, and we sat in on a lesson actually that was about, it was what we'd call kind of PSHE. It was about menstruation and sexual consent as well, actually, just about saying no and about knowing your body. And I thought, this is a lot better than the lessons that I had, admittedly, now some 15 years ago. But it was it kind of speaks back to your point about that, you know, because this has all been very rigorously data driven. In some cases, it's of a higher standard than you get in Britain, where we've developed this system much more piecemeal over time. Apart from cash, what are the things that are stopping you? What are the roadblocks?
I think that obviously, the more funding we have, the more we can do. I think it's teacher training, making sure that we have enough high standard teachers, librarians, obviously infrastructure. We need to have appropriate infrastructure to deliver. Partnerships, where we are looking for and developing very effective partnerships with government, but also with businesses to do projects together. We've just done something very innovative in Indonesia with Google around making visual and video versions of our books. So it's really just trying to find innovations and funds to unlock some of the blocks to scale that we see.
And what has been your favourite moment in all your time working with Room to Read?
Well, it's definitely that audience I had with Dumb Hawe in Cambodia. When I think back, it's very vivid. I can actually see the room. And it was particularly vivid because John Wood, the founder of Room to Read, had been bitten by a poisonous spider, I think, in Sri Lanka. Being John Wood, he persisted and bitten him near the eye. He was in agony. So he gave this incredible speech biting
his, oh my God.
in terrible pain, as any John would. And then Dumb Hawe managed to upstage him, frankly, by giving this very passionate speech from the heart about her personal and family benefits from Room to Read education. And even these hardened party carders in the audience who were from the regional government, you could see they were pretty moved by that. And I've kept in touch with Hawe. She, like many Room to Read girls, went through secondary school and then went to university and now works for NGOs and has a wonderful career and spreads the word about literacy and Room to Read herself.
Well, that's a wonderful story. Thank you very much. That was John Ridding, CEO of the Financial Times and Global Chair of Room to Read. And now for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
And you know what people have asked me this week, Stephen? Where are you going on holiday, Helen? And my answer to that is Madrid. I'm hoping to go to some museums, the Prado, for example. Do tweet me if you think there are any other things in Madrid you think I would enjoy. Where are you going on holiday, Stephen?
We're going to Lyon because obviously we fear that we won't be able to for very much longer. My partner is Francophile, speaks fluent French. I speak very poor French, but we will go. I'm maybe planning to carry through on the threat I make every time we go, which is to pretend to be some visiting diplomat and start yelling and demanding that she translates things to me. We're going to do some museum crawls and, you know, various things. So, you know, it'll be a good time.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, hosted by me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Parliament is now back, and although Stephen and I are away, there is still morning call. So do still sign up by Googling Stephen Bush morning call.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.